Very pleasant good evening to all of you tonight. Hope you've had a good day, and what a way to end it as we gather together and sing these songs with such spirit and conviction. And our brother has led a prayer to which we all can say amen, and for a few moments to open up God's book and talk about some things I hope will be helpful. I'm glad to be a part of this service tonight. I tell you what I love about Atlanta. It's always just like it is today. 75 degrees, very low humidity, and just wonderful. Well, I tell you what, you appreciate days like this. What an absolutely Chamber of Commerce kind of day. And as I said, what a way to end it. By the way, I need to keep up with when you folks are having gospel meetings, because I want to come back. I don't need to preach. I just want to come eat. I think I'll just show up and eat. Wow. I don't know what else to say about that. Oh, my. Open your Bibles tonight to 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. 2 Corinthians 7, verse 1. I want to talk a little while tonight about sacred marriage, but I'm going to use some verses this evening that maybe you haven't thought about in that particular context and in that particular way. And this is where I want to begin tonight. 2 Corinthians 7, verse 1. Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. I want you to notice that last phrase of verse 1. Perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Underline that. Mark that. One translation renders that, let us perfect holiness out of reverence for God. Now take that verse and that statement from Paul and just file it. Hold it just a moment. We'll come back there. We'll call his name Greg. Greg walked to his car, and he hit the button on the keypad to unlock the doors, and nothing happened. He hit it again, and nothing happened. The door locks didn't work. Now, he was able to take his key and manually get in the car the old-fashioned way, but when he did, it wouldn't start. And the gas gauge read empty, even though he had filled it up that morning. And in fact, nothing in the vehicle was working. It had to be towed to the dealership. And the mechanic finally gave the diagnosis to Greg, and he said, listen, you've got a bad BCM. He went on to explain the BCM stands for Basic Control Module. And he explained to Greg, this is the brain of your car. If the basic control module goes bad, nothing's going to work. Now, Greg could have insisted that they fix the door locks, and that they fix the trunk remote, and that they fix the gas gauge, and that they fix all the individual items that weren't working properly. But he was smart enough to understand that those were just symptoms of a much bigger problem. When it comes to marriage, I wonder how many times we focus on the symptoms instead of the basic control module. And so here's a couple, and they say, we need to work more on communication. Okay? But that's a symptom. Or here's another couple, and they say, we need to get better at handling conflicts. Okay, but that's a symptom. Here's another couple who says, we need to show more affection to one another, and we need to show more appreciation to one another. Okay, that's a symptom. Now, we can spend a lot of time working on the symptoms, or we can take a long look at the basic control module. And the basic control module for a Christian is a spiritual focus. It is a spiritual motivation. It comes down to this. Are you a God-centered spouse, or are you a spouse-centered spouse? Which one? A spouse-centered spouse will act nice toward her husband as long as her husband acts nice toward her. A spouse-centered spouse will go out of his way for his wife as long as she remains agreeable and affectionate. But I'm here to tell you tonight, God demands a lot more from us than that. What is it that Paul says in verse 1? We are to perfect holiness out of reverence for God. In other words, the number one motivating factor in all that we do, including this very special earthly relationship we call marriage, the number one motivating factor is reverence for God. I am not called to love my wife because she is holier than everybody else. I am not called to love my wife because she always makes me happy. I am not called to love my wife because things between us are always, every day, wonderfully ooey and gooey. Okay? I am called to love my wife out of reverence for God. Period. Perfecting holiness out of reverence for God. Which says that every decision that I make and every attitude and action that I undertake in this relationship has to flow from one holy motivation. Is this God honoring? You see, we can treat the symptoms all day long. But if you fix your basic control module, let me tell you, the symptoms will fix themselves. Think about this marriage thing. Do you think in marriage that God is calling us to happiness? Or do you think maybe God is calling us to holiness? You undoubtedly have heard of Socrates. Let me tell you and give you my favorite quote from Socrates. This is what Socrates says. By all means, get married. If you get a good wife, you'll be happy. If you get a bad wife, you'll become a philosopher. That tells us a lot about Socrates. Why didn't God design marriage to be easier? It sounds easy. In fact, on the outside looking in, it looks easy. My wife was at a wedding of some friends, and she's going through the receiving line, and she gives the bride a big hug, you know, and the bride says to Julie, she says, "Oh, I'm so glad the hard part's over." And Julie said, "Honey, the hard part's just getting started." You ever watch these romantic comedies? These movies? I hate to blow it for you. They're all the same. Every script is identical. Here is a beautiful couple and they meet under improbable circumstances, and then they fall in love, and then they fall out of love, and then they spend the final 30 minutes falling back in love. The end. That's it. Every single one of them is exactly like that. And it looks so easy. But it's not easy. And the reason it's not easy is because romantic love has no elasticity. You can't stretch romantic love. You try to stretch romantic love, and I'll tell you what's going to happen. It's going to shatter. Because romantic love is all about me. But mature love, holy love, sacred love, is able to stretch farther than you ever thought possible. Then again, it has to. Because when two sinful, selfish people start living together as one, let me tell you what you're going to have. Trouble. Unless each of them commit themselves to this higher, holier motivation. I'm going to do what I do out of reverence for God. Does it never dawn on us that God has a loftier goal, that He has a higher purpose for marriage than two people just living together and sharing the same mailbox and sharing the same kitchen table and sharing the same bedroom? Does it never dawn on us that maybe it's not your happiness He has in mind, but your holiness? Now, I'm not saying happiness and holiness are mutually exclusive. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying when you look at this marriage thing through the lens of God's purpose, you get a whole new perspective. And you begin to realize, this isn't about me. If you want to learn the ugly side of you, then get married. Because marriage will confront your immaturity. Marriage will confront your selfishness. Marriage will confront your control mongering. More than anything I know. And so what is the purpose behind this intense, lifelong relationship? What's the real purpose behind this? Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's to draw me closer to God. Because my relationship with God is going to last a lot longer than my relationship with my spouse. That's why working only on the symptoms are not going to work for very long. Now, we can try to make our homes peaceful and pleasant, and we should do that. We can work to make our homes the romantic side of marriage. We can work to make that alive, and we should do that. You can work in your marriage to show politeness and respect and kindness and courtesy for one another, and we should do that. But if your relationship with God is not what it ought to be, then all we're doing is treating the symptoms. Sometimes we look at human beings and we look for something in each other that really only God can provide. And I think that's why marriage dissatisfaction runs so high with a lot of people, because sometimes we expect too much. My first computer was an old 486. You remember those? The old 486 computers. We were going through the Smithsonian a couple years ago, or a few years ago anyway, and one of the kids said, there's Dad's computer. The old 486. You know what would happen if you take today's programs and try to run them on an old 486? It's not going to work. Now, it's not that the old 486 computer was bad. It's just that today you're asking it to do more than it can possibly do. And maybe sometimes we ask too much of marriage. If you're seeking the largest proportion of your life fulfillment from your spouse, if that's where you're trying to get your life fulfillment, then you're asking too much. Because you were created with a craving for God. And your wife isn't God. And your husband isn't God. Only God can fill the eternal ache of your soul. Now, when you finally get that, when we finally understand that I've got to take a look at and even replace the basic control module for this thing to work as God intends for it to work, then and only then do you gain a brand new appreciation for the person with whom you have embarked upon this earthly journey. Have you noticed how often in Scripture God connects His relationship with His people to marriage? You ever notice that? Isaiah chapter 62, verse 5, as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so God rejoices over you. Or Matthew chapter 9 and verse 15, where Jesus refers to Himself as the bridegroom. Or Matthew chapter 22, beginning in verse 1, where the kingdom of heaven is compared to a wedding banquet. Or Revelation 19 and verse 7, that talks about the wedding of the Lamb, and the bride has made herself ready. In the Old Testament, when God talked about the breakdown of spiritual fidelity among His people, He often depicted that in terms of marital infidelity. In passages like Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 8, God says, I gave Israel her divorce, and I sent her away because of her adulteries, He said. But perhaps no place is the sacredness of marriage seen with greater clarity than in that passage in Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 22, where holy matrimony is compared to the holiness of Christ and His church. In Ephesians 5 and verse 25, husbands, love your wives. Well, how am I supposed to do that? Just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself up for her. Verse 29. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church. Verse 31. For this reason, a man shall leave father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife, even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respect her husband. How can you read that and not come away with a higher appreciation for the holiness, for the sanctity, for the sacredness of this relationship called marriage? And what about 2 Corinthians 5:9? 2 Corinthians 5:9, where Paul says, therefore, we also have as our ambition. What is our ambition? Whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to Him. Do you think marriage is exempt from that? He says, our life goal, everything about us, comes down to that, to be pleasing to Him. The first purpose of marriage, beyond sexual expression, beyond the bearing of children, beyond companionship, is not about my happiness. It's about how can I live my life to be pleasing to Him. So here sits somebody and they say to me, oh, yeah, Frank just doesn't make me happy. And I want to say, news flash. It's not about your happiness. It's about God's happiness. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 31, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Is marriage exempt from that? Or would it include that? And if that's not enough, look in verse 15. Jesus died for all, so that they who live might no longer live for themselves. You mean it's not about me? No, it's not about me. Should no longer live for themselves, but for Him who died and rose again on their behalf. Is marriage exempt from that? I tell you, you start looking at these verses and God is demanding of me that I look at my life and I look at my relationship with my wife through the lens of His perspective. And I learn that my marriage is not about my happiness and my marriage is not about my glory. What I learn is that it's about His. While we're in the passage, look in verse 18. Now all these things are from God, who reconciled us to Himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. Now, let me tell you what Paul's talking about. Paul is talking specifically in that passage about the commission that Jesus gave His apostles to go into all of the world and to preach the gospel. I understand that. I get that. But is not the very work of the gospel, is not the very work of the Lord's church, in a sense, the ministry of reconciliation? That is to take the gospel, which is the good news. What's the good news? That man, who has been separated from God, can now be reconciled to God through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. That's the good news. That's the ministry of reconciliation. That's the preaching of the cross. Say, what does that have to do with marriage? Well, let me think a moment. Reconciled. Where have I heard that word in relation to marriage? I know. We've got some friends who can't get along, and they filed for divorce because of irreconcilable differences. Let me tell you, if our homes are fraught with fighting and animosity and distrust and anger and resentment, guess what's happening? My marriage is contradicting my message. And if my marriage is contradicting my message, I have sabotaged the goal of my life. And what is the goal of my life? To live pleasing to Him, he says in verse 9, and to share the message of reconciliation to others. A marriage that honors God, puts flesh on the very picture of reconciliation. Because a marriage that honors God becomes a model of forgiveness and a model of selflessness and a model of sacrifice. And what do you think are the basics of reconciliation in the first place? And so when we live together as husbands and wives, and we forgive one another, and we sacrifice for each other, and we put the other one first, that's a very small taste of what God has done for us and what He keeps doing for us. You ever thought about this? That your marriage will either be a stumbling block or a stepping stone for the gospel message of Jesus Christ. How can I tell my kids that the Father's promises of reconciliation, that God's promise is sound and secure, if they see that their daddy's promises don't mean one thing? Now, I think it's important to mention the exception. Paul says in Romans 12 and verse 18, as far as it depends upon you, be at peace with all men. And I tell you, you learn a very hard lesson as you go through life. And the hard lesson is, there's only one person you can control. And that's you. And if you have a spouse who is bound and determined to be morally unfaithful, let me tell you, there's not anything you can do about that. In Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9, Jesus addressed that very thing. He says in Matthew 19 and verse 9, I say unto you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. And so, God allows unfaithfulness to break the bond of holy matrimony, and He allows the innocent one to put their spouse away for that cause. And yet somebody says, there is no such thing as an innocent party. Well, what that means is, there is no such thing as a perfect party. But the issue isn't about perfection. It's about glorifying God in your life. And in any and every circumstance, regardless of what it is, the same question has to be asked. And that question is, what would God have me to do? And in most cases, God would want reconciliation. He would want me to do everything that I possibly could to reconcile and to make this work and to forgive and all of that. But sometimes when you ask that question, what would God have me to do? Sometimes that means making some pretty hard decisions, especially when spiritual lives hang in the balance and you have a spouse who is just determined to do wrong and doesn't want to change. So Jesus is pretty clear about that. Now here's the point. We live in a society where relationships are discarded with frightening regularity. We live in a society where people give very little thought as to the consequences of their actions. We live in a society where spouse bashing has become a favorite pastime. In contrast to those ideas and the way culture goes, and sometimes some Christians. When you have a couple and they work hard at maintaining a God-glorifying relationship, that couple will command attention. You see, our lives, our relationships, our marriages become platforms for evangelism. And through the example we set, we can either lead others to Christ or we could push them away. Let me take a poll. We hear a lot about polls, so I'm going to take a poll. How many of you have been married 30 years at least? Raise your hand. If you've been married 30 years, raise your hand. Don't be embarrassed. Raise your hand. Throw it up there. 40 years. 50 years. What feels like 100 years? These people who raised their hand, do you think everything in their life has just always just been great and perfect? And they are you kidding? People who've been married 30 and 40 and 50 and 60 years are living testimonies to us of the power of God's love and the power of forgiveness and, yes, the power of reconciliation, which is really the basis of the gospel message. Now, there's one more thing I want to say. And maybe you haven't thought about this. When you got married, you married a Christian. When you got married, I hope you realize you married God's child. Your spouse is just not another person. Your spouse is God's daughter. Your spouse is God's son. Your spouse is a child of God. Now, if you want to get on the good side of parents, then be good to their kids. On the other hand, if you want to make a parent angry, then pick on their child. Be mean to them. Be a bully. And you will fire up righteous indignation. How does God feel about His children? Listen to Zechariah in chapter 2 and verse 8. God says, "He who touches you touches the apple of my eye." I better think about that. Because I married God's child. You see, it's not just about me and this other person who happens to be my wife. It's about me and my attitude toward God's daughter. We spend time thinking about this analogy sometimes of the fatherhood of God. And we pray, "Our Father who art in heaven." Well, extend the analogy. If God is the father of the woman you married, men, then guess what that makes Him? Your father-in-law. And when you fail to respect your wife, when you demean her, or you mistreat her, or you speak condescendingly to her, let me tell you, you're courting trouble with your father-in-law. Listen to Peter in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, where Peter writes and he says specifically, "You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life." Why should I do this? So that your prayers will not be hindered. If you do not treat your wife with honor and respect, he says your prayers aren't going to go past the roof. I think sometimes we fail to grasp how passionate God is about the person we marry. First of all, God designed him or her as a one of a kind, and then God reconciled him or her through the sacrifice of His Son on the cross. That makes your spouse pretty special. And all of us will answer to how we treat the one to whom we are married. You know, I told you before, we have four children, three of whom are married. But I pray that all of my kids will marry and have spouses who will love them as much as do I. But I will tell you about all four of my kids, all four of them. They're not perfect. They have quirks. They have limitations. And like their daddy, they make mistakes. And so I pray that they will have a spouse who will be kind to them, who will be forgiving of them, who will be patient with them. And I cringe to think that they would marry someone who would be cruel to them. Someone who would abuse them, hurt them, or mistreat them. Now, God is fully aware of your spouse's limitations. God is fully aware that your spouse has quirks and faults and makes mistakes. But God is asking you to be as patient and forgiving with their faults as you want your kids' spouses to be with them. Think about how you treated your spouse this week. Think about that. Is that how you would want your daughter treated by her spouse? Is that how you would want your son treated by his spouse? You know, I look at this ring on my finger and I think about what that represents. And I tell you what I think about when I look at this ring. I'm reminded of something. And what I'm reminded of is this. I didn't just marry any woman. I married a daughter of God. I married God's child. And I know every day He is watching to see how I treat His precious child. Have you thought about that before? Maybe it's time we thought about that. Sacred, holy marriage. My wife is a great cook. She loves Paula Deen. And so for her 50th birthday 4 years ago, I think I just told you how old she is. Take that off the recording, please. Anyway, I surprised her with a trip to Savannah. And we drove down to Savannah for 2 or 3 days and ate at Paula Deen's restaurant. And by the way, if you've never been there, they have a gift shop. So, fellas, maybe you want to plan a trip some other place. I don't know. But they've got the gift shop and the whole deal. So, you know, she came home with all this Paula Deen's. She's a great cook. It wasn't long ago that I don't even remember now what happened. There was something that happened at home that she said, I want to cook you guys a really great meal and a great dessert. She said, I want to make you guys a chocolate pie. And so we were pretty excited about that. Luke got home, I got home, and so she cooked this fantastic meal, and she made this chocolate pie to celebrate whatever we were celebrating. And I mean, it looked like one of those pies. It almost looked fake. It looked so good. Meringue piled really high, and so we ate the meal, and it was absolutely wonderful. And so she cleared the table, and she went over there to start getting ready to serve the pie. Now, you've got to understand something about my wife. She's big on manners. I mean, major big on manners. And one of the things that It just is part of our rules in our home. That all the kids know that whenever there's dessert, you don't just start digging into it. It just sits in front of you until the hostess sits down. And then and only then can you eat it. So she served me. And she went back to cut Luke a piece, and I'm looking at this piece of chocolate pie, and I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be great. So I took my fork, she wasn't looking, and I dipped it into the end of that little chocolate pie there and got just some on the tip of my fork because that really doesn't count. And I stuck it in my mouth and just kind of licked it real quick. And I got to tell you, it was the worst tasting thing I've ever put in my mouth. And I knew exactly what she'd done. She left sugar out. She didn't put any sugar in it. It was horrible. And I started to say something, and then I thought, no, this is too good. Because she served Luke his piece. And if you've been around teenage boys, you know they don't take little bites. So she served him, and then she served herself, and she sat down, and she said, go ahead and dig in. And so I watched, and he got his fork, and he got a big old hunk of chocolate pie and stuck it in his mouth. And suddenly those eyes just went, and I mean chocolate pie went everywhere. And my wife was horrified, and she took a bite, and she said, oh no, I know what I've done. And she started grabbing the saucers, you know, the plates, and everything. And I said, wait a minute. She said, you're not going to eat this. And I said, you're right, I'm not going to eat this. But I looked at Luke, and I said, leave it be. And we sat there, and I want to tell you, my wife makes the best meringue pies you've ever put in your mouth. And I've often thought about that. Marriage every day is just not sugary sweet, is it? But sometimes you just eat the meringue and you love every bite of it. You know, it's easy to focus only on the faults of our mates, and when we start thinking in that direction, then every fault is just magnified. God says, I want you to see the bigger picture. And the biggest picture of all, he says, I want you to see that you're in this relationship. And through this relationship, I want you to glorify me. Maybe that will help us in our relationships and in our marriages to see things through the lens of his perspective. We sing the song of invitation tonight. If you need to obey the gospel and become a child of God, we sing this song and we encourage you to obey the gospel and become a Christian by believing in Jesus with all of your heart, confessing your faith in Him and turning from your sins and being buried in baptism for the remission of them. And there are people here tonight who will help you do that. There's no reason for anybody to walk out of here tonight who isn't a Christian. Or if you've wandered away and you haven't been doing right and you need prayers, you need our help and our concern, and you got it. We'll give it to you. Whatever the case may be, if we can help you tonight, won't you come while we stand and sing together?